as I was saying, there's kind of like gangsters need a shyster lawyer, painters need a poet to articulate their work, to write their catalogs, particularly when you start out. They also, in turn, are supportive of movement in jazz. All painters seem to be connected in the beginning with a jazz musician that they admire who touches them, and they talk about his work and they go see his work. One day, we would typically, I was with Gandy Brody and Robert De Niro, and we went to this restaurant on 6th Avenue in the Village. It's one of these all-night spots that were frequented by painters and jazz musicians. And we went there around 2 in the morning, and the place was strangely quiet. The only person there was Joe Albany. Albany was an older jazz pianist who was revered by all the other jazz musicians, young and old. He was really like, he would be an old man the way Pissarro would be an old man to the impressionists looking for a toehold and someone who could, was a father figure who could help them, you know, in a practical way and give them advice on their craft. Well, Joe Albany was there, and he really looked spaced out. And we said, "What the hell are you doing here? You should be playing. I mean, these boys come in around dawn, but this is early in the morning, 2 a.m. He said, "I'm not paid up on my union card, and not this and not that, and the business agent came by and shut down the gig, and I don't know what to do." And he said, "Well, how much do you need to bring your union card up?" He said, $25, which is like saying, this is really a lot of money. It's a lot of money then. It would be like saying, "I got to get $400 or $500 right now." Mm-hmm. So we said, "All right, we'll get the money for you. We know someone who, just wait here, Joe." So we left, three of us went in different directions, and we were to meet back at the restaurant. And Joe Albany promised he'd wait there. And we told the proprietor to keep him with coffee and food and not to let him out. Anyway, we got back there, I got back there 20 minutes later. I borrowed the money off of a mafioso soldier that was my neighbor, you know, on Thompson Street. He never didn't know anything about Joe, but he says, "Yeah," and he says, "You see that I get it back?" I says, "Don't worry." Of course, you'd be very careful about that, because you know, money off of a mafia guy, there's a 20% interest or more on that.
Who told you that?
Who told me that?
I mean, who said be careful about that?
It's something in the back of my mind. I had experiences with the mafia involving my entire body, and a contract that would have sent 100% to them. But he said there'd be no demand for the money. You pay it back when you can. I want to see that guy work. You'll take me to his next gig, said Vito. So I went back in the restaurant first, and Joe wasn't there. The guy said, "Well, he left with you, fellas." I said, "He didn't. We told you to keep him here, and where did he go?" He says, "I don't know, for God's sakes, you know." So then I had to wait for De Niro and Brody, and they turned up. You know, they also had money. And they said, "Where the hell is he?" I said, "He left." I said, "He left." The guy said he left with us. That we went out and he followed us out. So I said, "Well, that's a hell of a deal. Now what do we do?" So we went uptown in body and we checked the jazz places and no one had seen him come back that night. Everyone knew of the incident where he quit playing because of the union rep. For a reason I had gone into, I had to leave New York in a hurry. And to tell people in New York that you are, I was going to go to Los Angeles. I'd never been there before. I had across from the point next to the gallery, where it was on 38th Street, there was the Comedy Club Theater, which I think I told you about. And we had a 3-day lease. This was the French National Art Theater. That was its name. And other people would enjoy these 3-day leases. They were expensive. You know, you had a this time slot. And the guy left his stuff on the stage, you see. And so I threw it all out. Throwing it out was kind of a circuitous thing. You actually threw it out of the of a high window above the alley. Normally a crane would load it. I threw this stuff out and it was all right. Anyway, the guy whose theatrical set I erect this way was Professor Blankenship of USC. And I forgot all that I did to this man. And I was so happy when my own set went in, and I met the schedule, and somehow I had the idea that if I could go to Los Angeles and go to USC, I could certainly get a job with Professor Blankenship. And incredible as it may seem, he gave me a job. You see, I worked in audio visuals at USC, and in the theater department. And then I realized that I'd never really had spoken to people in my life. And I was asked to give a lecture on the things that I did to these people who seem so young. These were really the first college people I met, and, you know, broad campuses, you know. Of course, you can say that Greenwich Village and Washington Square is the campus, and it is, of NYU, but it doesn't seem that way, you know. There's such a mix of people from dope addicts, and they would occupy different corners of the square. But USC was this city, you know, with a student body of 65,000 people, I remember, and 4 or 5 theaters, and equipment that I'd never seen, hydraulic equipment that raised an entire stage, and lighting, and it was incredible. But anyway, before I took off to get a job from poor old Blankenship, and to avoid this lady who was giving me grief, my Robert De Niro and Candy were saying, "Oh my God, there's, how are you going?" I said, "On the Greyhound bus, it's quite simple." And to them, nothing existed outside of New York. There was a place called Hollywood, and some of them had been suborned and were now traitors to their craft and were working in a place called Hollywood. But, you know, Orange County, San Marino, these places didn't exist. It was as if there was a huge wilderness, like the Midwest was cactus-tile buildings, you know, and wandering cows or mad bulls. And these were, this was the anxiety that was conveyed to me. And talking as though New York, you know, a New Yorker can be found anywhere in this wilderness, they said, "Wherever you go, because we think that Joe left on a bus. So wherever the bus stops, Alfred, walk around and listen for his music and ask, see, and you know who to ask. You know, what do I do? Stumble up to some maverick steer and say, have you seen Joe Albany? You know, and it's dangerous. So anyway, but I did that. We went to parts. I remember that first drive out of New York. I suppose I should have been suffused with terror, but I wasn't really. The adrenaline was running as if I was home. I'd see my brothers in the morning, you know, or at the bomb shelter. And we drove through places like Gettysburg. And I remember I'd been there once before, you know. But I don't want to talk about that. This is when, years later, President Eisenhower moved to Gettysburg. And some students from Columbia took me there. Well, anyway, I don't want to go into that. We went into these little Pennsylvania towns, and there were people with beards. These were Amish people, or the plain folk, and I'd see them at night. I was doing sketches for the first time in the bus. I never do work outside of the studio. It's not like hauling a camera about. And I would dutifully get off the bus and listen. I thought, well, these bearded people won't know anything about Joe Albany. I couldn't hear his music, see. The bus stations in those days would always be in the poorer parts of town. I dare say this is true now, except for a gentrification in certain cities that have grown up and are wealthy. So we went all across country this way, and I didn't find hide nor hair of Joe, and I felt that I'd done everything to look for Joe Albany. You know, that this is the route, the trail he took, and yet there was no evidence of his coming or going. When I had to leave Los Angeles very hurriedly, because this young lady who was such a nuisance had caught up with me, I left.
Had what with you?
Had caught. You know, I caught up. Use the expression "cotched." I love it. I don't know why.
How would you spell it? I think it's funny too.
Cotched. COTCHED.
Okay.
It's a slang expression from somewhere, but I don't know where.
Okay.
Anyway, we went to. My friend said, "I'll drive you to Claremont, and it's a quiet little campus town. There are about 15 or 20 colleges there. You're going to love it, and this gal won't come anywhere near that place." Famous last words. But going back a minute, jumping back and forth, I was asked to lecture a group on my concept of theater sets. I felt that a theatrical setting should be, in those days, I don't think this way now, should be an accidental process. It should be a happening in which the actors participate. You see, they find things that they and bring them in, they create an environment for themselves. So I found that I couldn't talk to people, but I had an idea. And Blankenship said, you can talk about this. I mean, hell, you're the only one who can talk about this. You know, a happening. He said, so they dressed me up as the Tin Man, and I felt secure behind the Tin Man's prop, you know. And I began to talk. And anyway, I thought, God, I'm having a wonderful time here, before Ursula turned up. And the chancellor of the school was visiting the facility. Of course, the arts, something you better watch. The arts, you know, the theatrical arts was their showcase, an entree to Hollywood. And the chancellor spent quite some time there. And he listened to me lecture, and he said to Professor Blankenship, what the hell is this guy doing? I thought I'd be listening to something about the Wizard of Oz. And he said, Chancellor, he is kind of, has never spoken to people before. And so he came up with this device. And the Chancellor was angered by this and says, get rid of him. So I should have been upset, but within 24 hours, I had to go and move fast. And because of the young lady who's pursuing me, and Blankenship chose this moment to tell me about the sets that I wrecked. And I said, I feel terrible about that. I feel terrible about it. But he loaned me money to go on along down to Claremont. Well, I went to Claremont and here are these beautiful, engaging, charming people, you know, as that guy would say in that book, from the land of Beulah, from the land of milk and honey, talking about art and not realizing, not being able to comprehend the struggle. This should be the form of a lecture, which you've gone through in life. What you see is something that's beautiful. Imagine explaining to people that shrapnel from rockets spread out amongst fireweed, you know, the blossoms of fireweed, how beautiful that sight was of pink, and then these flashing silvery tones of the rocket skins. But at 10 o'clock in the morning, they would corrode because of dew. So this vision of the dawn hours after a bombing attack would be gone, you know, until the next air raid. How do you explain this? You know, do they start a war? You know, certainly an artist named Adolf Hitler started the war. He might have wanted to become aware of these aesthetic things. So I had, I thought, God, this is wonderful. Then everything that you needed was available. They said, well, where are you going to sleep tonight? I said, I don't know. So they found there was a house in which I slept, and people came from all over the place, and they had ukuleles and guitars, and they were singing folk songs. In those days, there were folk people singing folks. Peter Seeger was the nonconformist musical jingoist, and Claremont was the home of that wonderful songstress. Who was in her teens, but sang that night, came along and sang. Now, who was that, this Spanish girl? Anyway, I'll think.
Joan
Baez, whose daddy was a doctor and his mother was a teacher, or vice versa, you see. And I thought, where does this tragedy come forth when, from, you know, the voice of the professional people, you know, salary people, and this environment, but you know, the voice. And I began to think about this. Is there some genetic memory, you know, a genetic memory, and nothing can destroy it, not prosperity or horror. So I thought of these things, and then I thought, my God, what can I do for these charming people, you know, children in the land of Beulah, as our friend would put it in that book. The book about the artist Alec Guinness.
The Horse's Mouth.
What was the name of that?
The Horse's Mouth.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And he carried on about people living in the land of Beulah. I thought, my God, I'm in the land of Beulah. And I was quoting Joyce Carey. So I said, what can I do? And one of the hostesses said, well, we live just near Baseline Road. And if you walk along Baseline Road, you'll come across a liquor store. You see a blue light, and the blue light indicates the boundary, because liquor cannot be sold in a university town. And other people wanted to do this. I said, no, I just have to walk alone. I have to listen, you know. And they thought, it's weird he has to listen. But you know, he's this is the guy who's in his early 30s and possibly is in dotage, you know. So, and I left, believe it or not, to listen for Joe Albany. And then I walked to the blue light. There was a walk of about 3 miles. And it was just wonderful, this honeysuckle, and you know, this fragrance of the night. It was just a lovely little college town. I say this, but things change for the worse. So God only knows what it's like a half a century later. But it was so beautiful. The nighttime was so beautiful. And then I heard music. And here I am at dusk, bored at dusk, and now it's night. And I heard the music. I thought, these people know where Joe Albany is, in Claremont. So I walked towards the sound. So now I'm completely lost. The only thing I had in the night was the music. And I had to wait sometimes when the fellow would finish his riff, and then he began playing again. There were people accompanying him. And finally I found this house and walked in there. And I wasn't challenged. I saw a chair and sat down, and the people continued with their music. And when they got through playing, I said, "Where is Joe Albany?" And they said, "Man, do you know Joe Albany?" And I said, "Yes, I do. He's a friend, and we're looking for him. Lots of people are looking for him." And they wanted me to smoke pot as a check to see that I wasn't a cop. I said, I don't mess with that stuff. I'm not really a straight person, but I teach boxing. I was a boxer, and I can't mess with that. See, I can knock you all out. You see, there are about 7 people. I can do it in a flash. You want me to do that?" So I joined them up, and their suspicions were over, and they said, "We'll take you to him." I said, "Okay." And I said, "Where is he?" And he was playing at a nightclub in Laguna Beach. Laguna Beach is 140 miles away from Claremont. And I didn't know this, see. So I said, I'd been to the liquor store, I still had this bottle of, the kids, their favorite, the drink of choice on the campus was Christian Brothers Brandy. Always remember that. So here I am with this bottle of Christian Brothers Brandy, and I get in the back of this old beat up Buick. And there are 4 people there. There was a young lady who was also a musician, but she remained behind. They had a little baby. And they drove. And they wondered if they could smoke pot. I said, "I don't care what you do, just get me to Joe." So we drive through the night, and I was like, "Where am I going to find that house?" And then I thought, that it's more important to find Joe. So we drive to the back of this establishment at Laguna Beach, and we go in through the tradesman's entrance. See, the musicians go in through the tradesman's entrance. I mean, artists go in through the tradesman's entrance. I always resented that. And they sat me down at a table where I could see Joe and where he would see me. And I thought, well, there he is. And I thought, God, what a beautiful place. I remember these pigsties in which he played, like the 5 spot, the blue spot.
The blue note.
And they were really horrible places with an alleyway outside where people could urinate because of, you know, they wouldn't want to wait on the John being cleared. These places, and, you know, it was the music that was the only thing that existed in these places, and great music it was. And that would, you would be transformed by the music. But here's this incredible environment. It was cast on a slope, and it looked over the Pacific. It's the first time I'd seen, the Pacific, the Pacific Ocean, you know. And when the pianist, who was playing now in the style of Joe, approaches Joe during a musical break, and he whispers in his ear, and he's always saying, "Joe, there's this guy, his name is Alfred, from New York, who's looking for you." And Joe Albany turned around. The guy said, "He's over there." And Joe went like this. And I thought, I don't know where I am. Here's a friend. But the guy hurried back to my table. I said, "Man, you really know Joe Albany, you see." And I said, "I got to go back to Claremont now. He's all right." No. And that was the gesture he made. And I never warranted this, you know. I really loved that guy. It may have been something for Gandy Brody or Robert De Niro, you know. They may have stiffed him emotionally one way or another. Always boils down to that. And I wanted to tell him that there was nothing to tell him. But in triumph, these kids took me back to Claremont. They said, wow, you really know Joe Albany. They mentioned some other dignitaries who were treated in this fashion by Joe. So now the problem was to find out where the house was. Now back in Claremont, you know, at a familiar hour to me when, you know, I'm awake and alive, the moon is out, you know, I've seen great things. And we methodically came back along baseline. We found the blue light. They said it was 2.5 miles away, so we figured that out. And then I looked for the house, and I looked, and I said, this is the house. I remember this thing on the lawn, and the house was dark and black. I thought, well, the party's over, and this sort of thing happens. I thought, I think this is where, I hope the people are there who had a place for me to sleep that night. But the musicians were saying, you can stay with us, don't worry about that. And then, as I approached the house, there was a smell of gasoline. And then J.R. Cooley, the guy who brought me to Claremont and eventually took me on to Houston, Texas, said that girl was here and she's coming back. She's threatening to come back and burn down the house. God damn. I said, well, how did she find out about this? He said, well, she went by my mother's house. This is in Brentwood. And her mother said, well, my son is visiting Claremont at his old alma mater. So I said, that is why this happened. I told you to keep your mouth shut, you see. And I said, well, we've got to get out of here. Do you have any other suggestions? Putting the guilt trip on him, you see. So that's how I wound up in Houston, Texas.
Okay. You smelled the gasoline. Was it ignited? Had she poured gasoline?
No. Okay. But the lights were out. Everyone fled this woman who came in there. Once again, this was not someone whose constitution had anything to do with happiness. She was this someone born of a German Nazi regime, you know.
Another question. The last time I heard anything about her, which was when I wrote that paper, the way you told the story was that you had arrived in Los Angeles and gone to the British consulate and gotten a job, and they'd referred you to the owner, I think, of a British owner of an antique store.
Yeah.
And you were there one day, and then some guy, a stranger, comes by, you strike up a conversation.
Yeah.
And somehow you learn you need to leave town, and he takes you to Houston. So this is a little, can you clear up this?
Yeah. I needed a job after the chancellor said he doesn't want non-academic people in there, you see.
Uh-huh.
And so in desperation, I called the British consul. And they said, you're lucky. They said, we have...
From Claremont? Is that right? Or are you...
I'm calling him from Los Angeles, from USC.
See, I don't know the geography there. So you went...
Yeah.
First
I'm in an apartment building that joins the campus. Of USC. And it was really a private apartment building that had students and none other in there. And I was really staying with the Fergusons, who were schoolmates of Elliot Budd Hopkins in Wheeling, Virginia. When I lost the job in the theater department, I thought I'd better find something fast. And in desperation, it was really desperation, I called the Brits. And they said, yes, we have a job for you, and it's tomorrow in the morning. I said, well, when do I... you don't see the guy. You will check in at Ruddleston's antique store in Brentwood.
Where'd you spell that? Ruddleston, R-U-D?
R-U-D-D-L-E. Ruddleston.
Reddington.
Yeah, that's it, Ruddleston. Okay. Colonel Ruddleston. Okay. America's familiar with Errol Flynn and Robin Hood and the marvelous antique tables in the castles where they ate oxes and eyeballs and huge turkey legs. These tables were furnished by Colonel Ruddleston, who arrived there as a consultant to that whole genre of movies. When I arrived, it was almost like the Empire State Building that had a sign out for dishwashers they needed desperately. And he was desperate because he said, "Today is July 4th. I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yeah, it's like Guy Fawkes Day in England." He says, these Yanks celebrate their independence and kicking us out. Colonel Ruddleston was a Yorkshireman, an Englishman, and his wife was English too. I said, "Well, what do you want me to do?" He said, "You see that black cannon out there?" He says, "You paint that. You'll go out there with lamp black," and I was familiar with lamp black. "And you paint it black, and you hoist the flag, and the flag here is the Union Jack. We don't have the stars and stripes above it or beneath it, you see. And if anyone gives you a hassle, you know, as if anyone in the land of happiness and Beulah, whatever, you see," this was something that satisfied him. And anyway, there were people who came by that day who supported this notion and understood the humor of it. Catherine Hepburn, who was a charming lady, and who was looking for things to give her fellow actors in a movie. It must have been the African Queen or something like that, because she bought a carved skull's head for Humphrey. And Lord Nolan lived down the street, and he sort of approved of the cannon polishing, you see. And this was July 4th, and so on and so forth. So I worked there for more than a day. I worked there for a couple of weeks, actually. And living at the end of the alley, you know, you have these wonderful concourses, marvelous avenues, and you have these connective alleys, you see. Not like any city alley in say London, but you know, there'll be trees and things like this, you know. And this is where J.R. Cooley lived. And he would come down the alley and he would encounter the cannon on the corner on the main street. And the business across from Ruddleston's antique store is a farmer's market. And the farmer's market was wonderful because they had Jewish delicatessens for obvious reasons, because the industry, people in the industry. And you could see stars there quite anonymously. It's just wonderful. And actually, food from all over the place, you know. So I took a lunch break with JR, and I said, "I got to get out of here." I explained to him about this girl that we...
Okay, I need to ask you, okay, because part of my question is, somehow you're in Claremont, so I don't know, you said J.R. Cooley took you to Claremont. Was that on a weekend trip, or was it in transit between USC and L.A.,
Claremont is about 40 miles outside of Los Angeles. And to Angelenos, this is not really a distance. This is like saying, we're going out to university, and that's 3 or 4 miles. It's a weighted 4 miles because there's a degree of difficulty in winter and stuff like that. There are elemental difficulties. But in Los Angeles at that time, there's lots of traffic, you see. But it wouldn't be difficult. You would be there.
So you lived there and worked in L.A., is that?
I worked at USC and lived in the apartment building,
right,
with the Fergusons, you see, who knew Elliot Budd Hopkins. Ferguson was the son of the bitch responsible for bringing Ursula to America. Now he's marrying his childhood sweetheart, and she's finishing work. kind of a mess, you see. And anyway, when Ursula turned up, I thought if she sets fire to where they're
an apartment building,
and she's mad enough to do it. The funny thing is, I had a sympathy for her. She was brought up to believe that Jews were subhuman. You see.
Okay, let me just get this cleared up, and then we'll come back to
okay.
Ursula, because it's been the typing of it.
Yeah.
We're going to get way off track. Somehow, look, this is what I understand. You rode a bus from New York to the L.A. area.
Yeah.
And you got a job at USC, and you stayed, or you were helped by the Fergusons.
The Fergusons and Blankenship,
and,
yeah.
Okay, and you stayed in an apartment building somehow connected with USC.
Yeah.
Is USC in L.A.? I don't know where it is.
You
just give me a name of a town.
Los Angeles.
All right, that's good enough. Then, my next question is, you got fired from the job at USC, or you were let go, or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you thought, I've got to get a job. You called the British consul.
Yeah.
And then you got a job at Rudderson, whatever.
Rudderson.
Okay,
yeah.
But somehow, at some point, you were staying connected with J.R. Cooley. I don't know how you met him, because you haven't said, but...
Yeah.
But, you someplace in here is this night about Joe Almany from Claremont. So, when were you in Claremont? Was that just a visit, a weekend visit?
No. We didn't plan on a weekend visit to Claremont.
Who's we?
J.R. Cooley, my guide.
Your guide. And
yeah.
How did you meet him?
At the Cannon. You would pass coming down his alleyway, he would see the cannon, and he knew what it was all about.
So you were working by then at the...
Working, yeah.
Okay, now we're getting clearer. Okay, so you have the job, and he comes by, you get acquainted.
Yeah.
And when is Claremont? When is that evening, that night you went looking for...
He said, I told him what the problem was, and he seemed to be, you know, a sympathetic person, someone I could talk to. He looked like one of these people with the bohemian patina, you know, as if he'd come from New York, did J.R. Cooley. And he offered to get me out of there. You see, I said, I can sweet talk this girl. I know that Ferguson will keep her under control, but I have got to get out of here.
Out of
Los Angeles, out of you.
Okay, and
that's the
place you were living.
Yeah. Okay. USC is like mentioning a city with a population of about 100,000 people.
It's an area.
Yeah, it's an area. Not to be confused with UCLA.
Right.
USC is a private school. The largest private school in the world. See? You have to have brains to get into UCLA. There are exams and stuff like that. And they hate one another on that basis.
So by now she showed up. You meet Cooley from the job where you at Ruddleston.
Yeah.
And you need to get out of town.
Yeah. Okay. I said, why don't you call the police? I said, brother, I can't call the police. I'm not where I'm supposed to be. I'm in this country illegally, but I'm an artist, and we get into these kinds of jams. And somehow he had heard of me. You see, notwithstanding the wilderness they portray in New York, this guy had heard of 10 Americans. Yeah.
No,
yeah. He heard of the show, he heard of de Kooning, and who was the senior painter. And now I assured him he's talking to the young guy. And that was me. And the de Kooning, too, had jumped ship here. We all like that, you see. And so anyway, he became very protective, and he said, he was negotiating for a Cadillac convertible. He said, the thing is that if we can leave quietly, he said, I can pick you up at the USC building, you see, or maybe Mr. Ruddleston will let you sleep in the garage where we did all the work, polishing a pewter and stuff. I said, no, I don't have the heart to tell the old boy that I'm going to leave because he likes me, and I don't explain what my problem is. To Edwin Ruddleston. So I said, so anyway, we were 3 days locked into this situation. I said, when are we going to leave the goddamn place? Why don't you take me to the highway and let me hitchhike the hell out of here? And he fought me off. He said, well, what about? I said, I don't care about my clothing. I don't want to go back. He said, I'm worried about my life and other people. And finally, he had been negotiating with some former silent movie star living up in the hills who had this fire engine red Cadillac with this cream leather furnishing, and he bought it off of her. And I thought, oh no, how can we leave, you know, in an anonymous fashion in this love boat, you know. When I saw the car, my heart sank. I thought, well, this is California, get used to these goddamn things. And it cost him, this wonderful thing cost him all of $500. Anyway, so finally, in my work clothes, do I jump in this Cadillac convertible and we head for Claremont, you see, where I was to live in peace. And then Ursula turned up at the store. They said there was this fellow from down the alley, yeah. So she spoke to the mother of JR. I said, I don't know where your friend is. I've never met him, but my son left with a friend for Claremont. So, you know, that was out. So then we kind of gathered ourselves up, and he took me on to where he had a friend, some friends in Houston, Texas, you know, an alumnus who was a doctor who came in handy later on, and Percy David Bell. When we left, finally we were heading for Texas. I thought, well, nothing. It's terrible when you're in a retreat, you know, you flee from a situation. And but I thought, well, nothing can stop us now. We're here. We are. You know, I felt like this. Some.
Okay. All right. So if I'm correct, if understanding, he took you up to Claremont, and then the event happened about Joe Albany. Were you that night? That
yeah.
Occurred during a 2 or 3 day period in.
Yeah.
Claremont.
Yeah.
And then you left. You had to get out of Claremont because.
We had to get out of Claremont.
Okay.
And Joe Cooley took me out of Claremont.
Okay.
Now we're heading. For Houston, we're still in the state of California.
Okay.
In California, there are certain paintings where, right on line now, I'm not going off at a 180, there's a distinctive brush stroke, you see. Sometimes it's a minuscule thing, but it's like handwriting, like signatures, you see. There was a painting that, always impressed me because of its brush stroke, and it was of an eagle with wings spread above a landscape, and it was by a primitive painter, and the work was a gift of Nelson Rockefeller to the Museum of Modern Art. And after admired the painting, I thought, you know, what does the guy like, since he was targeted to buy our paintings and so on and so forth. Now he was one of the directors of the Museum of Modern Art, and was supporting this new movement secretly with hundreds of thousands of dollars.
The art school. Is that what you mean by movement?
Artists, individual artists, de Kooning principally.
Okay.
He became the godfather of de Kooning's daughter born out of wedlock. The man was on an alcoholic binge for 8 years, and he made him promise to attend Alcoholics Anonymous on Long Island, and he went there with him until he remained with it. And he also commissioned him to do Merritt Parkway, which was the painting that took him out of that alcoholic trough. He got $100,000 for that, and then came on stream. But anyway, of all the paintings I've seen, the one of the eagle turn, I judged at the turn of the century, I thought, man, the signature of this guy. There were, he used a half-inch brush and turn it like that, you see. And it's like composing something out of clamshells, this signature, you see. And, but there's no signature in the painting, but there was some, a line of a pansy-like flower. In the Museum of Modern Art, in the permanent collection, no, in New York, but I never forgot it. Anyway, Cooley said, I'm going to see my grandma. And I said, did you tell your mother about this? He said, no. I said, well, don't get her on the phone. Just, where is she? And she lived in some place like San Bernardino. But I could be wrong there. But it was one of these small, prosperous, Southern California towns, and I thought, oh shit, we're gonna spend time with this freaking grandma. What the hell? So we drive by these modern buildings with stainless steel facades, and all the clues of a very active chamber of commerce, and then there was this clapboard house. Corn cobs drying on the sheaves of the porch, and there was a lady sitting in a rocking chair. Of course, the only thing she lacked was a gun, but the gun was propped up against the door. And I said, "Who the hell is this? I mean, this is right next." He said, "I want to explain something quick. She owns the downtown, so they leave her alone." And he said, "I got to talk to her before we go." I said, okay, it's fine with me, fine. So we walk into the house, and I saw something that was the most electrifying sight